Our first lesson had to do with attitudes. It's a lesson that we'll be continually, the ideas that we'll be continually referring to as we go through the study. Our second lesson had to do with definitions. And this lesson has to do with passages. We're plugging in the definitions into the passages. Is there anybody that needs a copy of the lesson tonight? It says passages on the top. Need another mark? Did you need more? Why was it important that we study definitions before we study the passages? Okay, to understand them in their true light. What? Some
proper application.
Okay. If you're studying with somebody on the plan of salvation, and so you say, let's study the Bible on the plan of salvation. They say, fine. So you open the Bible and it says that Jesus sent out the apostles and told them to make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And so you're talking with this person and you ask them, have you done what the Lord said? And they say, yes. And it so happens they're members of the Methodist Church. They're honest. They believe that's the Word of God. What's the problem?
They were likely sprinkled.
That's right. They were likely sprinkled instead of immersed. Definition makes the difference. And that's true with our study. You talk about marriage. What is that? Divorce. What is that? Adultery and fornication, same thing. So when we look at the passages, it's very critical that our definitions are those that fit the way they used the word in the first century. Okay? So Romans 7, we're looking at Romans 7. We've looked at the passages in the Gospels, Matthew and Mark and Luke. Now we're looking at Romans 7. Let's begin our reading in verse 1 and read through the first three verses. Or do you not know, brethren, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law has jurisdiction over a person as long as he lives? Let me stop a moment. This is the thread of his thought, the jurisdiction of law. To illustrate that point, he draws a comparison to marriage. His topic is not marriage. But incidental truth is truth nonetheless. And so, in making the comparison to marriage, what he says about marriage is certainly true. For, he said, the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living. So his point is, the law has jurisdiction as long as a person lives. For a woman is bound by law to her husband while he's living, but if her husband dies, she is released from the law concerning her husband. So then if, while her husband is living, she is joined to another man, she should be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, so that she is not an adulteress, though she is joined to another man. Therefore, now he picks up his main thread of thought that he introduced back up in verse 1 that he'd been talking about in this book. But to illustrate the jurisdiction of law, he introduces the law of marriage and its jurisdiction. So let's pay attention to the things that he said here. He said the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living. Just like that illustration we used on the word baptism, where it becomes very critical as to whether we understand the plan of salvation, this word bound is open to different definitions that will change our perspective as to what this teaches. So it's important that we define this word contextually by the law of context and harmony. It was interesting. Sally sent me a website about the words fornication and adultery by some fellow who's supposed to be a scholar. And he talks about what adultery means. And just to give you an example, he said adultery did not have to do with a man's sexual relationship with a slave or a prostitute. It was with a respectable woman. Now, so if you're going to define words but like that, where are you going to end up? I don't know where he got that. But here's the thing about lexicons. You've got renowned lexicographers. Art Gingrich is one, Thayer is one, Vine is another. And they based their definitions on documents and letters and those kind of things that were current at the time of these writings. And they're recognized authorities in that field. So that was very interesting what she said. I do not agree with that man. Based on context and based on the law of harmony. Same is true with this. So if a preacher gets up and preaches about this, and maybe he's been preaching for 50 years, and maybe he's renowned, it doesn't mean what he says is so, does it? We need to be able to define these words. As we prayed with Javier, we need to equip ourselves so we know what these passages teach. And so, from your English dictionary, write the definitions of bind that connote obligation. You find a definition that connotes obligation? Pretty simple.
Constrain a legal authority to put under an obligation to exert constraining or compelling
power. Okay, you've got more than one definition there. That one of them is obligation. Put under obligation. That's one. You're obligated to do something. That is a definition that's given to this word sometimes, and we'll see that it causes a problem. There's another definition for bind, and it has to do with restraint, and it was included in what Wally read, to constrain with legal authority. So it's as if to say limits. Here's something you can't do. Obligation. Here's something you need to do. Here are your duties. You're bound to do that. You'll see, and hopefully as we go through the text, that this becomes very important. So here's two possible definitions of bound in our language. The question is, which one is meant in the text? Okay. If you read Matthew 28:19, and you want to know what that means, what the Lord meant, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could go ask him, what did you mean by that? Same is true with other writers in the New Testament. So Paul wrote this letter. Wouldn't it be great if we could ask Paul what he meant by that? Let Paul tell us what he meant. It so happens we have another letter he wrote, 1 Corinthians. And it so happens in this other letter he's discussing this same topic of marriage and being bound. And that's chapter 7. Just hold your finger at Romans 7. We're coming back to it. So in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, Same writer, same subject. He draws a contrast in that verse. One of the ways to know what someone means is when they draw contrast. If you can understand one side of the contrast, it will help you with the other side. And so here we have, a wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, there's your contrast. The husband's alive, the husband's dead. When he's alive, he's what? She's what? What did he say? Bound. If he's dead, she's what? Free to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. So if that's what it means on the other side of the contract, free to be married to whom she will, what does bound mean?
Not free
to be married to whom she will. Constraint. Same writer, same subject, same word. He defines it for you. You don't have to depend on a preacher. You don't have to depend on a lexicon. You can compare the two passages. There's another thing about this word bound, and this is important. We'll see this as we go through. Now, some of these things that we're studying now, when we get to the lesson on positions, and by the way, it's going to be in parts. The first part's in the back. You can pick it up. We have on the sheet 13 different positions. I don't know if we'll get to them all or not. But some of them we won't need to spend a lot of time on because they grow out of the very things that we've been studying. And so if we understand these passages that we're looking at, they'll help us when we get to those positions and the ideas that are advanced. But nevertheless, in this verse, he talks about a woman being bound by law to her husband. Here's a question, and it's an important one. Is this a legal or a physical bond? It's a legal bond. How do you know it's a legal bond?
Because they're not tied together. Literally.
No, maybe that's the picture of them being tied together with a rope. The law. She's bound. What does it say? Bound by what? By law. Is that legal?
Yes.
That's legal. It's a legal bond. Now, the next word, bound to. We ask you to look up the word to in the English dictionary. I don't know how many definitions you came up with. One dictionary I looked in had 18 definitions for the word to. We read the Bible, we plug in a definition, but does the definition fit the verse? And so here's this little word to. Now, if a person reads this verse and they're thinking that the analogy of is of a physical bond, like bound by ropes, bound to, you see there's a connection there. And if it's a physical bond that the analogy is making, when you free one person, what happens to the other?
They're free too.
That's right. But that's not true biblically. We'll see that as we go. All right. Now, so we ask you to look up the word to. One of the definitions that indicates in reference to something. This is from the Webster's New World Dictionary. As concerns, in respect of, involving. They give you some illustrations. That's all there is to it. That is in reference to it. Open to attack. In reference to attack. Another dictionary says indicating or identifying a particular relationship between one person and another. He is married to Jan's cousin. Relationship, reference. And if you look this up in your dictionary, you should be able, if it's a good dictionary, to find this potential meaning of the word to. Well, that doesn't prove how it's used in our particular text. So we look down at Romans chapter 6 and verse 2 All we're going to do right now is establish that this concept of reference to is a potential biblical definition. It's at least one we need to consider. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 2, he talks about those who have died to sin. What does that mean? In reference to sin. Died in reference to sin. What does Romans 7:4 mean? He said, you are made to die to the law. What is that? In reference to the law. So we know it's a potential meaning, see? And here we find it, in fact, used that way in a very close context to what we're studying. Chapter 7, verse 4. And where he's talking about jurisdiction of law. Dying to law. In reference to law. Now, here's another question. It says that she's bound by law to her husband. And when we talk about the position. I told you in a previous class, I met up in Wichita Falls many years ago with a bunch of preachers. And there was a man who was advocating. And he was a good man to my knowledge and a good Bible student. But he was advocating that when a man puts away his wife for fornication, he's obviously not bound. That's the necessary conclusion. Why? You defined adultery. How did you define adultery? What? It's an unlawful sexual relationship, but that won't be enough. Where one is bound to someone else. Right? Where'd you get that definition? Where in the Bible? Romans 7. Romans 7. Okay. So if a sexual relationship where one of the parties is bound to somebody else is adultery, but the Lord said whoever puts away his wife except for fornication commits adultery, we conclude if he puts her away for fornication and remarries, it's not adultery. So the necessary implication is that he is not still bound to that first wife, correct?
Yes.
Has to be, or else the second marriage would be adultery. Correct? You with me? Ah, okay. If bound here is the analogy of a physical bond, bound to, and he's free, you got two donkeys tied by rope, you cut the rope, what happens? They're both free. And so his argument was the fornicator's free too.
No.
Because bound to, if one's free, both free. Widely taught. There's another man, and a man I learned a lot from. Good man, very knowledgeable. I don't know if I'll ever know as much about the Bible as this man did. But his view was this. The problem that he presented. He said, okay, you've got this man that puts away his wife for the cause of fornication. So he's free to remarry, correct? Right? And so here you believe the woman is still bound to him, right?
No.
He put her away for fornication. She's not still bound to him?
Oh, she. I thought you said she is still bound to him. You said she's not.
Isn't she?
No.
She's not?
Yeah.
What got her free?
She's bound to him, but she's fornicated and decided not to be with him.
He puts her away for fornication. Are they married?
No.
Is she still bound?
Yes.
Yes. Otherwise, she could go and have sex with somebody. It wouldn't be adultery. Yes, she's still bound. Okay. What?
Unmarried but still bound.
Unmarried but still bound. But here's what this guy presented. He was a good thinker. He said, wait a minute. You mean to tell me the Bible obligates that woman to still be that man's wife, to render him wifely duties, when the same Bible says he's free to marry somebody else? Now that presents a problem. You mean God said he can marry somebody else, but tells that woman you still need to be his wife? There's the problem. That's why the definition of bound is so important, and that's why you understand it's a legal bond, not a physical bond. These are what we do. We're trying to. I know sometimes brothers think, why are we so particular about things like this? Doctrinal issues, somewhat like a railroad track. You look down a railroad track and it looks parallel. But what if every 1,000 feet it's off 1 inch? You look down that railroad track, will you see it? What's going to happen in 10 miles? You're going to have a problem. And if we don't get our thinking straight, we may not see any problem here. But way down the road down there, no telling what that's going to lead to. That's why we want to try to get our thinking straight up here, because we don't know where it's going to end. And that's why we want our terminology correct. We want to understand these passages. Okay? All right, so we've got some questions here. Can a legal bond bind one person in reference to another? That's probably not a good question for the class. I've got something in mind. Let me just use my illustration. And this gets back to this. Can one person be bound and the other not? Let's say you go to Sears and you buy a television. And so you buy the warranty, let's say, or maybe it just comes with a year's warranty or whatever. They'll fix it if something breaks. And so there's a legal contract between you. And Sears is bound by that contract, and you're bound to pay for it. So you set up payment for a year. You get it home, there's a Western on. Your kid gets a BB gun. Says, well, I want to get in this movie. And he shoots the bad guy on the screen. Bust out the TV. Is Sears still bound?
No.
No. Are you still bound to pay for it?
Yes.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. That's the difference in a legal bond and a physical bond. And so here's one person bound in reference to another, and the other person is no longer bound. We understand that in legal terms, and this is a legal bond. Okay? Look at, Well, just do it right quick. It won't take but a minute. Look at Deuteronomy 23. When you make a vow, this is verse 21, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be a sin in you. Now look at Numbers chapter 30. This is under the old law for the nation of Israel. Look at Numbers chapter 30. And look at verse 2. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. So under the law, you're an Israelite. You take an oath either to do or not to do something. You vow that before God. You're bound by God's law. A legal bond to do or not do whatever you said. Correct? Okay, so in marriage, how do you enter into a marriage?
Vows,
a covenant, and then, of course, sexual consummation. All right, look at Judges chapter 11. This is a familiar story to our class. You're familiar with the story of Jephthah. You see in Judges 11 and 30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. Now when he made the vow to the Lord, according to Deuteronomy and Numbers, what happened? He's got to keep it. He's bound by law, right? So he makes this vow. He said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. It's a controversial passage as to what he really meant. Some think that he was saying, I'll kill it. I'm not sure that's what he was saying. So they say, here came his daughter, and he's obligated to kill her as a burnt offering. I doubt that's the meaning of the text, but that's another study. What I do want you to see is when he got home from his victory, it didn't turn out like he anticipated, did it? Because the first thing to come out of his house was his daughter. So would you call this a rash vow?
Yes.
Yeah. Was he still obligated to keep it? Yes. You know, somebody may get married and say, man, whew, that was a mistake. Let me back up. Too late. You make a vow, you're obligated to keep it. That's certainly true with the marriage vows. And so what that says is we better be careful about making those vows. Those of you who have young children or children who are contemplating marriage, you better talk to them about vows and rash vows and that you're bound by the law of God when you make those vows. Now, in this particular case, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. Did the Lord do his part? He did. Was the God bound in any way now? Was he?
God didn't make a vow to Jephthah.
No, but it was a vow he made to the Lord. If you give me the victory, I'll be at my daughter. So God gave him the victory. Is God obligated to do anything else? Or is Jephthah still bound?
Yes.
Yes. See, a legal bond can be a one-way thing. So keep that in mind as we study this passage. In Acts 23, verse 12, that's so different, you see, from a physical bond. Look at Acts chapter 23. Now, these are Jews. We just read the Jewish law. You make a vow, you're bound to keep it. Either to do or not to do, whatever you vow. And so in verse 12, when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. So their vow had to do with constraint, right? We will not eat or drink till we kill Paul. We vow that, okay? And you see that again in verse 14. Taste nothing until we have killed Paul. So here's our question. I just got a statement. They bound themselves under an oath in reference to Paul. Bound to, in reference to Paul. And this bond had a restraining effect. We won't eat or drink till we do this. So here's an example of a vow that had a restraining effect. Okay, now here's an important question. It's number 5 on your lesson. In marriage, according to Romans 7, let's go back to Romans 7. Let's just stay with the text. Let me caution you now. If you go, and you'll see that when we get to position. You say, I got to study this subject. I tried this years ago. I started reading debates and articles and sermons. And I tell you, the more I read, the more confused I got. The best thing to do is go back to the text. Just keep going back to the text. What does the text say? So, here we have, it says, a married woman is bound by law to her husband as long as he lives. And the only thing that frees her from that in this text is what?
Death.
Only death. The reason we conclude, necessary conclusion, that there's one more thing that frees her is because of the except clause in Matthew 19. Otherwise, it would be useless, superfluous. Whoever divorces a wife and marries another commits adultery, period. But he said, except. Puts away his wife except for fornication. And so evidently in those cases, it's not adultery. Therefore, we conclude he's no longer bound. Or it would be adultery. Okay? So, in our text, both parties are bound. In the case of death or divorce for fornication, Matthew 19, the law, the same law that bound sets one free. Correct? It sets the mate who's still living, but their mate's dead, that mate is free. The person who divorced their mate for fornication is free. Here's my question. Where does the law, not I think, it seems fair to me, or doesn't seem fair to me, or brother so-and-so said, where does the law set the other person free? The one who was divorced by the innocent party. Where did the law set that person free? Anybody know of a verse? I know of none. That's where the Bible leaves that person, bound. Bound, not obligation. But plug in the definition for bound that Paul gave. Not free to marry. That's where the law leaves them. Okay? Let me ask you a question. You know, this runs into things that just boggles our mind because we think, good grief. Here this man's no good and he's out committing fornication and maybe his wife doesn't know it. And he divorces her. 2 months later, she finds out. Now she can't divorce him for fornication because she didn't know it. So, man, it doesn't seem right. Here's a couple that's been married for 40 years. She helped put her husband through college. She worked so her husband go to college and get a good job. She was the mother of his children. She gave her life to him. She devoted her whole self to him. And after 40 years, he says, I'm through. I'm going to get me a young thing. Or maybe he's not. He says, I'm through. I'm through with you. She's heartbroken. 40 years. She's now, say, 60. 2 months later, she finds out he's got him a young thing. And he's sleeping with her. Can she divorce him for fornication? Why? Can't divorce not married, but that's the exact right answer. What does Romans 7 say about her? What state is she in, Romans 7? She's bound. The law left her bound. What about the man? Is he bound? Yes. There's only two ways to be free according to the law. Your mate dies, or you put away your mate for fornication. You like that? This woman's 50 years old, or 60 years old. She's going to live to be 78. She finds another guy who's a good guy, about her age. She'd love to have him as a husband and spend the last 15 years of her life with him. You can say, okay. She asks you, can I marry? What are you going to tell him? Depends on whether or not we trust God and His wisdom, His authority. Go by what's written. Right? Two 20-year-olds marry. They don't get along. They fuss and fight, so they divorce. 6 months later, one or both get married. Or 6 months later, they get interested in somebody. Can they marry? They're only 20 years old. I didn't make the law. You can take it up with God. But whatever that law is, I may not understand it, but it's for our good. And what it certainly says is what Javier prayed. We better take this stuff we're studying and say, you know what I need to do? I need to take care of my marriage. I need to treat my wife right. I need to treat my husband right. I don't want that to happen. What that says is we better be teaching our children about the vows they make. This is serious business. Okay. So that's that last paragraph I have down there about rash vows, and we need to take our vows seriously, and God's a witness. We may say, it was just a ceremony. No, it's not just a ceremony. God's witness to the vows we make. We better think before we get into a relationship. We better think before we leave it.
Now, you are not bound once your spouse dies.
That's right. That's what that Romans 7 says.
Well, there was flash when you said, well, the only way is you make nice or...
He said your mate dies.
Oh, I didn't hear that. It sounded like flash.
Look at me and not at Aurora. Thank you, Keith. I want to clarify that. No, if your mate dies, you're not bound. That's what Romans 7 says.
I gotcha.
Okay, good. All right.
There will be people who would take that, you know, totally all the wrong way. Well, okay, once you divorce, regardless of why, then you're bound even after death. And I know that could be a whole other can of worms.
Right. And there's, look, Keith, I'm glad you brought that up. There are good brethren who believe even divorce is not a cause for, if you divorce your mate for fornication, even divorcing for fornication does not open the door to remarriage. They believe there's no, and death too. That's what I meant to say. There are people that even in the case of death, they don't believe you can remarry.
Well, that's what I wanted to clarify.
Yes, sir.
Can a woman divorce a husband for unfaithfulness and remarry?
All right, we'll ask the class. Can a woman divorce her husband for unfaithfulness and remarry? You answered yes. I want a scripture that proves it. What?
Romans
7 talk about putting her mate away for unfaithfulness? Matthew 19. Whoever puts away his wife, Mark indicates it goes both ways. So she puts him away for sexual unfaithfulness. If she marries again, she commits adultery. But he put an except clause, didn't he? If he puts her away except for fornication. So in those cases, when she remarries, it's not adultery. So yes, Alex, if you fool around, Margaret can get rid of you or shoot you. Sir? Yes, sir. So, we looked at Mark 6. And so, Herodias had been married to Philip. Right? And so, if that was a lawful marriage, even though she's now married to Herod, who is Herodias bound to? To Philip. And Herod got rid of his wife. I think the story is that she actually left him when she found out about him consorting with Herodias. So he's married to the second woman, but who is Herod bound to? First wife. That's right. That answer your question?
So they were married but not bound to each other.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
Not bound by God's law. They were married. They're in the relationship.
They were married.
But it's what did John say? It is not lawful for you to have her. That's a good point, Todd. They were married, but they weren't bound to one another. Not by God's law. Maybe by civil law, but not God's law. Yes, Levi?
Hey, for the circumstantial game, but just to be clear, even the so-called adulterer or adulteress, she can still divorce the husband for adultery. Even the adulterer is free to remarry once their spouse, if their spouse dies before them, yes?
That's what Romans 7 says. Let's look at that question. Levi asked that question. Person commits adultery. Here, this woman right here, it says, if while her husband is living, she's joined to another man, what is she? An adulteress. But then it says her husband dies. Levi's point. What does the text say? She's not an adulteress. Even though the text says she's joined to another man. Now that bothers people. You mean to tell me this woman is living in adultery and her husband dies and now she can keep this guy? Somebody says, no, that's sin. Well, what sin is she committing? Tell me. Is it adultery? He said it's not. Now, she needs to repent of her past sins. It doesn't take care of those. But her present relationship, according to Romans, if I understand it, is not adultery. Yes, sir. Okay, does it make any difference what's on the civil papers?
No, but I'm saying there was unfaithfulness of her husband, and that's why they got divorced. But maybe very applicable to me, but that's...
Okay. Remember what the text said. We're going to study that in one of the positions, if our time allows. And that is... Does it make any difference who initiates the divorce? We're going to look at that. But not tonight. All right, we've got one more passage, 1 Corinthians 7. Very, very important. We'll look at that, the Lord willing, Sunday. The first part of the lessons on position is in the back. Pick that up. We'll have the rest of that printed out. The first section is there in the back.